I wanted to first give you an overview of what the state of civil rights for lesbians and gays are, and then talk a little bit about how we're trying to organize ourselves politically to work for the things that we think should be done, and then maybe open it up in some way to a discussion maybe of what you think about what I said, and also maybe some strategies or options for people who aren't gay who want to try to be affirming people and things that people can do. So you can turn on a microphone. I mean, you could start the tape now, you guys. I'm sorry I didn't say it right off the bat. First of all, on civil rights, we talked a little bit yesterday about the fact that only 20 years ago, things were very different for lesbians and gays than they are now. And I'll just read you a little thing I wrote in about this, because when I grabbed all of the information about what's going on in the country right now and read it in one swoop and then sat down to think about what I was going to say, I wrote this. I wrote like crazy. I was very angry, and this is what came out. And I reread it and said, well, this is, you know, this is about as good as I could say it, so I'm just going to read from a little bit of it. No more than 20 years ago, I would probably have been booed out of this room for even mentioning lesbians and gays and civil rights in the same sentence. It was quite inconceivable that lesbians and gays had any civil rights as such. Discrimination and harassment in housing, employment, and public accommodation.
So I think it is not
a conscious norm. For almost all lesbians and gays, the closet was all-encompassing.
Now, the conclusion yesterday was
the closet, the catchphrase that implies its own reality. Lesbians and gay folks lives were so duplicitous and so affected by external and internalized homophobia that they could only be themselves in tiny, dark, and claustrophobic rooms. Co-workers, neighbors, families, friends, straight friends were rarely, if ever, aware of the lesbians and gays in their midst, and for good reason. Being openly gay was the justification for being fired, evicted, ostracized, attacked, and in the majority of states, arrested. The only safe places were a murky subculture of bars and clubs, which encouraged alcohol dependency and stereotypical behavior, and which were only as safe as the owner's most recent payoffs to the police. Raids and mass arrests were regularly held, both to look good in crime statistics and to up the cost of the extortion. This is the stuff I was talking about yesterday. There were trapdoors in bars that people at risk were allowed to crawl out of when the police came. Both people who had jobs that they would lose if they were arrested, and also, unfortunately, the underage, because it's also for young lesbians and gays, these were the only places to go to. And the underage would end up in juvenile detention special wards. Okay. So in 1969, in one of these places, after the third or fourth police raid in a month, this is in New York, in Greenwich Village, in a bar called the Stonewall. The gay men that lived in that area started to fight back, and there were three nights of riots. And the riots sort of marked the beginning of the gay liberation movement, or what was called the gay liberation movement at the time. But it was basically the first time that gays, and it was mostly men in the Stonewall riots, stood up and said, no, 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 we're not going to do this anymore. We don't want to do this anymore. And Gay Pride Week celebrates it's that moment in lesbian and gay history. At the end of every June is Gay Pride Week, and it's the anniversary of the Stonewall riots. Since Stonewall, lesbian and gay Americans have become more and more visible, especially in large cities. Gay communities began to emerge and organize to claim some basic human rights from the iron grip of the closet. Today I want to talk a little bit about the state of those rights and the fronts on which some of the battles are being fought. First and most important in this, I just want to give you a little bit of background on this before I go into other stuff, but this just to give you a sense. First and most immediate in implication is the question of legality. Now, the legality question has a very funny history, and it goes back to Queen Victoria as its perfect example. In England, buggery or sodomy was illegal, but lesbianism was not, because Queen Victoria refused to believe that women would do such a thing, and so she refused to outlaw it. So, you know, Oscar Wilde was shut up in the Tower, and Virginia Woolf and Vita Sackville-West were running around all through Bloomsbury, and, you know, and it was that kind of weird double messages and strange legal situations has continued in the United States. Most states have anti-sodomy laws. I mean, the states that have any laws around this, they're anti-sodomy laws, which are loosely interpreted as anti-homosexuality laws and are upheld as such, but they're actually about a particular sexual act that gay men and straight people can indulge in anytime they care to. Other states have no anti-sodomy laws, and still others had them once but struck them from their books. So depending on where you live in the U.S., where I live in the U.S., I'm either legal or illegal by definition. And if I cross state lines or go someplace, my most memorable example of this was in 1975. I went to visit some people in St. Louis. And we were some other lesbian friends of mine. And we were out at an all-night bowling alley bowling. And it was in 1975, it was the height of the sort of gay everybody's as out as they can be kind of, you know, time. And so we were, you know, hanging on, and the two friends I was visiting tended to be very demonstrative, and sort of, they were sort of acting out in this bowling alley because there were some sort of drunk macho fellows next to him that were yelling stuff at him. And all of a sudden two cops walked in and they like stopped and sat down and looked uncharacteristically scared. And I said, "What's the matter?" And they said, "The cops." And I said, "So what?" And they said, "We could get arrested. It's illegal. We can be arrested for being lesbian or gay in Missouri." And I was like, oh, I suddenly realized, my God, I crossed the Mississippi and I became an outlaw, you know? And it was a very strange feeling. I felt like Jesse James, you know, whoa, now I'm an outlaw. So the situation has always been very muddy, just even in terms of legality, and that was made even more strange in 1986. I don't know if y'all remember this. The Supreme Court issued a ruling in June of 1986, upholding anti-sodomy laws and the rights of states to have them. It was a case that was brought from Atlanta, where they had an anti-sodomy law in Georgia, and the case was made it finally to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said some really scary things that I think have implications for all of us, not just for gay people. The Supreme Court ruled that the historical proscriptions against homosexuality, quote-unquote, have ancient roots, and that the importance of intimate associations in a free society and the rights of consenting adults in their own home as part of ordered liberty were, in the majority's words, at best, facetious. The court goes on to state that to justify state-mandated morality, which I think has horrible implications for all citizens. Now, all across the country, when this court came out with this ruling, and it was a 5-4 ruling, it was a, you know, Reagan court gem. The newspapers all across the country roundly condemned this ruling, and it was very heartening to lesbian and gay folks that it was understood, it was perceived by the press and by most people in the country as this ruling was a terrifying assault against everyone's right to privacy. You know, I mean, the consenting adults in their own home kind of thing, and here's the court saying no. And the case that it was brought on was a case where literally the person who was arrested was a gay rights activist who had angered the police chief for some reason. Police chief burst into his home in the middle of the night while he was asleep, found him in bed with his lover, and arrested both of them. Okay, and this happened, I think, in 1982. Okay, but the court ruling was 1986, and the court upheld that right. And that's pretty scary for everyone as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, as we speak here today, I'm still illegal in 18 states, and the court has affirmed the right of any other state that cares to outlaw me. Now, I think also in the light of the current, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow, current legislative hysteria about AIDS. I mean, there's lots of repressive legislation being passed because of AIDS. I don't think I have to be paranoid to be worried. I think that much more of, you know, the court has opened the door to some really scary stuff. Now, other legislatures have been more supportive in the basic human rights of lesbians and gays. And it sort of makes me feel like we could become nomads if we needed to. Oh, Wisconsin has a gay rights law. Let's all move to Wisconsin. You know, several states and local governments have passed non-discrimination laws. My home city, Chicago, is right involved in a very heavy one, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit. Wisconsin is the only state that has a gay rights law, and it's in danger of being repealed right now because they've changed governors, but the city of Madison also has a gay rights law. So I guess all lesbians and gays in Wisconsin could then move to Madison if it's repealed. Now, if you're catching sort of a note of cynicism in my voice, congratulations, because the reality is that lesbian and gay basic civil rights are at best tenuous. They're different wherever you are in the country. And most of the time and the effort and the money of gay communities and gay people who are active is spent in just shoring up and being able to be sure that they can maintain basic civil rights. And that's a really, I think, sorry state of affairs. Though, as an organizer, I guess the one bright spot is that civil rights struggles really do make activists out of people very quickly, you know, and hope maybe that's a hopeful thing. We'll talk about more about that in a minute. But I do want to just give you these statistics and let you think about them and to justify my cynicism. Since 1981, the incidence of anti-gay violence has increased phenomenally. In 1986, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force released a report documenting 4,500 reported attacks on gays and lesbians because of their perceived sexuality. Now, I stress perceived because a lot of people were attacked who really aren't lesbian or gay. It might be just an effeminate-looking man or a frail man. Or a woman who does a job that's very physical and looks very strong. And I stress reported because studies show that 90% of attacks, anti-gay violence attacks, go unreported for obvious reasons. The police, it's very, very much like the state of issues around sexual assault, rape and sexual assault before the country became more aware of it. The police don't like to deal with the cases. The criminal justice system is very unreceptive, and it could mean, you know, having to lose your job or whatever. People are just afraid to report it. So if you take 4,500 and you add 90% on top of that, you're talking about 45,000 attacks on people in 1 year based purely on a perceived sexuality. Now, that's horrifying, but that was an 83% increase over 1985, which was a 41% increase over 1984, which means that 36% of lesbians and 22% of gay men reported being physically attacked at sometime in their lives, which makes lesbians and gays four times more likely to be the victim of a violent crime directed at their sexuality, because of their sexuality, than the normal American citizen. Think about that for a minute, because however we feel and whatever we think here, there are people out there on the street dying. The most famous case of this in Chicago, though it goes on all the time, is the editor of the major gay newspaper, weekly gay newspaper in Chicago, a guy named Jeff McCourt. He was sitting in the office of the Windy City Times, the name of the paper, putting the paper to bed, and four people burst in the door with baseball bats and beat him senseless. He broke his arm in about four places. He had a skull fracture. The only reason they didn't kill him was that he's very athletic. and very strong, and he was actually able to fend them off and get until they got scared. They heard people coming, and they left. I have examples here I could give you. They're pretty horrifying. A New Jersey gay man was assaulted by three men who extinguished cigarettes on his face, tied him to the back of their truck, and drove along a highway with him in tow. A man arrested in Vermont for the 1985 shooting and killing of a gay man explained why he shot the victim, who he'd never met. He said, "I killed him because he looked like a fag." So, you know, in the light of all of... Oh, and here's the most frightening part about it to me. 28% of these incidents of violent attack have been against people with AIDS or used... The phrases used in while the person was getting beaten were AIDS-related. Things like, you know, it's, you know, you're killing us all, you know, it's, you're, you know, we deserve to die, et cetera, et cetera. So that when you bear in mind that the fact that all of the stuff about AIDS, and we'll talk about it tomorrow and how frightening that situation is, and the sort of scapegoat mentality that this kind of violence means, and then you realize that AIDS is quickly becoming a disease of poor people of color, and we'll talk again more about this tomorrow. This wave of what's called fag bashing could easily become a new wave of racial violence in this country, and it's really frightening. It's very, very, very frightening to me. So I just wanted to lay some of that stuff out. I have a lot more stuff on it, including facts that besides just the physical violence, there's a lot of harassment going on at college campuses, gay and lesbian groups, you know, or meeting, discussion groups, blah, 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 have been attacked, have been, people have been dismissed from campuses, et cetera, et cetera. And we can talk maybe more about that. I have a lot of statistics on it. So, you know, these horror stories, I mean, I just want to sort of place them in the context, or place you in the context of them so that you can understand why I say that our struggle is not to try to figure out whether, you know, the Bible is right or wrong, or what the meaning of the Hebrew words are, or whether, you know, this church should become open and affirming, or any kind of that stuff. We're out fighting these battles, and these are very terrifying battles. And I think that when we talk about trying to be people of goodwill, there's something just wrong about people being murdered and people being beaten in the streets, no matter what you think about them. So I want to move quickly from that. That's a little overview of stuff that I had done last week, to a little bit of how it's tough for us to even begin to organize and to work for these things, for reasons that I'll tell you. I don't know if any of you remember this, because the press, characteristically of the press, didn't cover it very well, but last October, over 300,000 lesbians and gays marched on Washington for 5 days.
Did the press say 100,000?
Yeah, maybe 100,000, yeah. Maybe, yeah, I right. That's right. Yeah, and it only got in the Sunday papers. They were there from Friday through Tuesday, and somewhere buried on the third or fourth page of the Sunday papers were the reports from the Gay Pride. I mean, it wasn't Gay Pride, it was the March on Washington. Now, if you remember that the famous March on Washington, the one that we all think of, Martin Luther King, you know, I Have a Dream speech, was 200,000 people, and it was a day and a half. So that's a pretty impressive thing, that 300,000 lesbians and gays marched on Washington last October. And the parade, I wasn't there myself, but the parade, the march, was described to me, and I've seen pictures of it, and the most impressive part of it was that contingents from all over the country were there, and they were carrying banners. And the contingents were not just, you know, here's Here's the gays and lesbians from Chicago. They were AIDS support groups, religious denominational affiliates like Dignity and Lutherans Concerned, etc. They're professional organizations, gay doctors, gay nurses, gay lawyers. All the choirs and the choruses from all over the country. There's a big, huge movement. Big choral competition happens every year of gay men's choirs. All the choirs were there. The pro bono legal aid clinics all over the country. Motorcycle clubs. There's, you know, that ride motorcycles together. Local political organizations of every conceivable stripe, including lesbian and gay elected officials, of which there are about. There's quite a few. I mean, not that many, but quite a few. Now, for many that marched, the Washington experience was one of incredible empowerment to see so many lesbian and gay people in one place. And many people who went to that march had never been politicized before, had never done any work before. They just heard it was happening and they went and came back with their lives changed. Like any other minority group, lesbians and gays aren't monolithic. There are radical leftists, conservative Republicans, work in the system types, direct action and civil disobedience advocates, and folks who are just plain apathetic. Some of us believe in traditional hierarchical leadership style, while others are committed collectivists. We come from every part of the country, every class background, all races and ethnic groups, and both sexes. Achieving unity in this type of diversity is all but impossible, and therein lies the struggle for organizers and for our community. How do we work for compromises that will maximize political power in numbers? Because there are, I mean, 300,000, if we're conservatively talking about 10% of the population in the United States of America, we're probably talking about over, let's see, there's 2 billion people? 200 million people. So 20 million lesbians and gays in the United States of America. A lot of people. So how do you get these people to come together and work together and organize around something that they hold in common when they cover every other distinction that you possibly can? There are, you know, black and Hispanic lesbians and gays. First, just the thing about lesbians and gays, and I'll talk about that in a minute. There's a big political difference between lesbians and gays. And, you know, class stuff and this political spectrum, it's a very weird group of people in terms of from an organizing perspective. The lesbian and gay community is also slightly schizophrenic in terms of political experience. There are those of us who've been around politics for years, cutting our teeth on civil rights, anti-war, women's, environmental, anti-nuke movements over the last 20 years. Though they weren't directly and aren't directly related to lesbian and gay issues, these movements taught us how to organize, fundraise, horse trade, work the media. I myself trained as an organizer in high school during the civil rights movements in Chicago. I did my first electoral politics in the McCarthy campaign before I could vote. I was involved in the early years of the National Organization for Women. I ran election campaigns for progressive candidates for local political office, and I produced women's music concerts and broadcasts on radio. Now, most of my lesbian friends have resumes not too different from mine. We've been around the political block a few times, so to speak. On the other pole are the folks who never had a political thought in their lives until recently. The white gay male stockbroker who lived the high life, ate the best food, drank the best wine, and didn't give a hoot about what political anything until his best friend contracted AIDS, lost his job and insurance, and is now left to die with nothing. Or the radical lesbian separatist who wouldn't participate in the patriarchal political realm out of principle until she becomes enraged that the Catholic hierarchy has torpedoed a gay rights ordinance. This contrast in political style and experience, as well as the reasons for politicization, has made for some interesting internal debates in the last few years. Choosing your allies and setting agendas for action are especially difficult. And here I just want to say a few words about just the basic what? Maybe it's a suspicion. Maybe it's a... I'd say it was suspicion or wariness between lesbians and gay men. For many years, lesbians felt that gay men gave them a bad name, gave lesbian's a bad name. I mean, sort of a general feeling because gay men were so much more visible and we're out there doing all this silly bar stuff and going out and going disco dancing and, you know, and having this sort of, giving this impression that to be lesbian or gay, you were just this sort of party animal who stayed up all night. And meanwhile, lesbians over here were, you know, sort of very involved in the women's movement and being very political and just really, lesbians and gays didn't get along very well in terms of working in coalition. Because there were just so few things we could agree on. Now, that has changed somewhat because of AIDS. AIDS, more than anything, has brought the closest thing to consensus to the lesbian and gay community. It doesn't take too much of a leap of empathy for the lesbian separatist to feel the pain and loss of a gay male whose lover has died penniless without access to adequate health care. Nor can the conservative Republican help but be enraged by the kinds of repressive AIDS legislation introduced by his ideological kin. All lesbians easily realize that the wave of hysterical violence prompted by irrational fear of AIDS can be and is easily transferable to from gay males to lesbians. So coalitions have emerged around AIDS issues that are laying the groundwork for further activity. Again, we'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow, but lesbians have been in the forefront of most of the work that's been done around, well, especially lesbians who have had a lot of political experience come in, and you know, here's gay men who really basically weren't that very, very political, and now they're being, you know, they're suffering this horrible thing going on in their community, and they don't know how to organize around it. A lot of lesbians are in the forefront of organizing around AIDS issues. One of the most interesting things, and I don't know if you've heard about it or seen anything about it, that's been happening along this line is the NAMES Project. The NAMES Project was the quilt that was displayed in the place in the big lawn in Washington during the March on Washington. It was the size of 3 football fields, and it was made up of 3x5 squares that had been quilted individually by friends of people who died of AIDS, that were memorials of them. And they came from all the way around the country, and then and lesbians and gays organized the NAMES Project, and groups of volunteers sat and sewed them together. And this thing takes the size of 3 football fields, and you just walk through it and you see, you know, to my dear friend John, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's a very, very moving thing to be in the midst of. People who saw it in Washington said that the minute that you walked, you know, out of the parade, and everybody was like, yeah, parade, 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 and walked into this place where just as far as you can see was this colorful thing on the ground that represented people who had died. Everyone got silent and just walked slowly through it and looked at it. Now, the NAMES Project is on the road now. It's coming to Chicago in right after 4th of July. I think it's July 7th through the 11th. And it's on the way. It's on its way around the country, and it's being used to raise money and to raise awareness on AIDS things. And that is a national. I mean, it's sort of like taking running a political campaign and taking a candidate on the road. It's this major national thing that's happening. And it's unheard of 2 years ago. So I'm inspired by the NAMES Project, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that. Another interesting dynamic that I would just want to raise, and then maybe we'll stop and talk among ourselves a little bit, is that the lesbian and gay community, and most especially the gay male community, has discovered that one thing it can do is fundraise. That there is a sort of an untapped, and maybe it's because gay males especially tend to have very high incomes, especially white gay males, because they're not married, they don't have families, there may be 2 of them, so they're, you know, they're double income, no kids, dinks. And they tend, because they're men, they have access, a lot of them are professionals and highly educated, have access to really good jobs. Not the same, not as much true for lesbians. But anyway, now that these things have started to happen, Things like the Names Project, things like openly gay candidates running for office. The discovery has been that there's no problem with fundraising. Now, if you've ever done fundraising for anything, for your church, for a political thing, for whatever, and you know how hard it is to, you know, spend 6 weeks putting an event together and selling the tickets and doing the stuff only to make $5,000 or $6,000 or $8,000 or $10,000, there was a new PAC, Political Action Committee, started in Chicago, just to give money to candidates from the gay community to sort of be able to have some sort of political influence in local political issues. The name of this PAC was called Impact, and they had an opening dinner that cost $100 to come to. And to declare that they were going to start this PAC, they made $175,000 tonight. And that's one city. This added to the fact that effective lobbies have had a serious impact on AIDS legislation. I know people who are now lobbyists and are getting paid to go down and work for the Chicago AIDS Foundation, to work with the General Assembly to try to get good AIDS legislation passed, something unheard of 2 years ago. The budget of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force has increased from $50,000 in 1973 to $700,000 in 1987. So that there's a possibility out there. The one thing we don't have unity, but we can raise money, and that's something that we're struggling with right now in terms of how to deal with that. I can tell some stories, and I would like to, but I think maybe I should just see if anybody has anything to say here about what's going on in my home city, and I have also some ideas about things that people who would like to be supportive should do, but maybe I should just see if anybody has anything they want to say first. Go.
Well, I grew up in an extremely conservative, sheltered, small little farm town. Mm-hmm. And the first time I had any personal acquaintances that were gay was when I went to grad school at University of Oregon, mm-hmm. in Eugene, which has a pretty sizable gay population. And at the time, there was some legislation pending that would protect people who were gay from being kicked out by a landlord, or denied housing by a landlord, that sort of thing. And it was pointed out that reflected on the rest of the community too, mm-hmm. that if somebody was living with his girlfriend or were staying overnight, the landlord then could come and make a fuss about that also.
Right.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting that it not only affected the homosexual population, but the rest
of
it.
Oh, sure. And that's a real important strategy. It's one that I can talk about, how we're doing it in Chicago. That is that in order to get, I mean, it's still kind of hard to sell a legislature on standing up and voting to give those people mm-hmm. civil rights. But it's impossible for legislatures to vote against civil rights now. So that the way the political organizing is being done is to say, I'll tell you the Chicago story. We had what was being called the Gay Rights Ordinance. It had been in committee in the City Council in Chicago since 1972. And when Harold Washington was elected in 1983, he promised to bring it out of committee and to get it on the floor of the City Council and to get a vote on it. So, I mean, it was 12 years. You know. Finally, in 1986, Washington worked very hard, and he was able to get it out of committee and onto the floor. And he took a lot of crap, sorry, but he did, from out there, from the newspaper, from the press, rumors about his sexuality that had always been sort of bubbling under the surface burst out. I mean, it was really a mean thing. But the way that the ordinance was written was it just added the word sexual orientation to a litany the city shall not discriminate on the basis of race, creed, color, blah, 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 and it would be, you know, sexual orientation would be added. Well, for a myriad of reasons. The bill was, we had the votes in the council, and it was coming up the next day, and everybody was expecting it to pass, and that night, the Catholic Cardinal, Joseph Cardinal Bernardine of Chicago, who had been in support of it all along as a civil rights issue, stood up, called a news conference, and said he no longer supported it because it would force the Catholic Church to hire gay and lesbian, or something like that. He pulled the rug out, which then gave some of the aldermen a good excuse to be able to jump ship, and so the measure failed by about 5 votes. And it was, well, first of all, it made a lot of gays and lesbians in Chicago pretty upset with the church. But besides that, you know, Washington called people together and said, look, we're going to reintroduce it after the next mayoral election, so start working on a different piece of legislation. Excuse me. When they rewrote it, instead of doing that, you know, where you just add the word sexual orientation to all of the existing statutes, they wrote a bill that would, strike all the existing statutes and add a whole new chapter in the book, in the code, that was called the Human Rights Ordinance, or the Human Rights Law would be what it was. And it was a restatement, but in one place, of what already existed, but adding to it no discrimination by virtue of physical ability, age. I mean, it just included everybody it possibly could: race, creed, color, religion, national background, physical ability, age, sexual orientation, and wrote it that way so that it hasn't been reintroduced yet. It's probably happening right about now. I'll find out when I get back home. But so that a Chicago alderman, to stand up and vote against it, he's going to have to say, I'm voting for discrimination. You know, I mean, he'll be held responsible, his feet to the fire, by blacks and differently abled people and blah, 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 blah. Or even if he wants to try to strike the word sexual orientation from the, you know, to amend it, to strike that word, then he's going to have to stand up and do that. I mean, the way that the strategy is, and I think it's a much better strategy, is to so clearly equate civil rights for lesbians and gays with civil rights for everybody that it's going to take a logistical leap for any elected official to try to weasel out of it. And we'll see. But it's exactly that thing. So you point out, you do as much as you can to say, you know, just like the anti-sodomy law, or the Supreme Court decision, that, hey, this isn't just about me. This is about you too. is the implication here is that the state can burst into your bedroom now. If they don't like what you're doing, they can arrest you. We need to do that. Or else, you know, we need to, like, indicate solidarity with everybody else. You know, sort of like, hey, we're right there too, kind of thing.
And, you know, in terms of the violence thing, yeah, that has always bothered me. Mm-hmm. I've always thought there's got to be a reason behind that hate. And there must be a feeling of being threatened, you know, that these people who attack gays must have those feelings somewhere deeply buried inside, and they're afraid they're going to emerge someday. And just to take another example, you know, Hitler's fostering hatred towards the Jewish people didn't come out of nowhere.
No. Nope.
He presented them as subhuman and a threat to the economy, da-da-da-da-da.
Absolutely.
But my friends and I used to go up to Portland for the midnight movie. It was usually Rocky Horror
Picture. Yeah.
And sometimes a couple of our gay friends would come along, and once we went to a gay bar for under 21.
Yeah, right.
And the cops were right there checking everybody out and asking, are you gay? And we all said, oh, yeah, we are, even if we weren't.
Yeah.
To get in, you know, and be with our friends. But I guess there'd been a lot of violence against gays recently, and they were really checking it out.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't help thinking, if you're really not threatened by this, you wouldn't be attacking these people.
Well, and most lesbian and gay people would say that too, and you know that kind of striking out against someone, you know, is an indication of being really weird, really closeted, and really frightened. But now, see, the scary part is that what's surfacing as the excuse is AIDS. Uh-huh. See, now they're using that as a justification, so that what you don't just have this, you know, oh, let's go beat up some fags. You know, it's like, you know, I saw there was an Oprah Winfrey show maybe about 2 years ago with people who had been convicted of beating up gay people, and Oprah on the panel, and Oprah talked to him, and they said straight out, "I feel that it is my assignment from God to murder gay people to stop AIDS."
Except that you know, going on long
before that, exactly. But it's the scary part is now there's this sort of it could be used as a justification, as an excuse, and so that's why. I mean, AIDS. Those statistics I gave you, starting in 1984, these huge increases in violence. Well, when did AIDS hit the national consciousness? 84, 85. Mm-hmm. You know, those were the years that suddenly everybody started to become aware of it. And so that's the frightening part about it to me. I mean, it just seems really very intense.
When you're talking about this bill or whatever, mm-hmm. that's just for the town of
City of Chicago. City of Chicago. Mm-hmm. It would be an ordinance in the Chicago statutes, which would prohibit, you know, so it would basically just... It's the same as any civil rights kind of thing. Housing, employment, and public accommodations kinds of things. I mean, the same wording that were used. It just, you know, you can't be refused an apartment because you're gay or you're perceived to be gay, you know.
Is there really a large group of activists that have been able to do that with the large cities that they live in? Like, for instance, Seattle, that's mm-hmm. what I'd be in touch with the most.
Seattle is, Seattle, first of all, has a very, very large population of lesbians and gays. A lot of people have moved to Seattle because of, in fact, it's, I was just in Seattle the first time when I came out here. I visited some friends who moved from Chicago to Seattle, and I was walking down the street on Capitol Hill and was like, my God. Everybody that lives in this neighborhood. You know, amazing. But Seattle does not have a gay rights ordinance. There are people who are working on such a thing in Seattle, but it does not have one. The only state that has one is Wisconsin. And then New York City has one. St. Paul, Minnesota has one. Strange places. I think Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, one of those has one. And then other places. But
what kind of ordinance do they have in
St.
Paul, Minnesota?
That's a what you would call a gay rights ordinance. It's illegal in
St. Paul.
Yeah, it's illegal to discriminate in housing, employment, etc.
Wasn't there something that was just passed too that gave rights in terms of employment
in St. Paul?
No, nationally. That just got through the legislature.
The one that President vetoed. Is that what you're
saying? Yeah,
speaking?
The one that Reagan vetoed.
Right.
And then, but it was overruled.
Right.
Yeah. What was that?
Well, that was. I'm not sure. I mean. That was the Civil Rights Restoration Act, wasn't
right.
it? Okay. And the Civil Rights Restoration Act basically was a... I have to go back and... through Paul Simon's office, we dealt with this all the time, and I have to try to make sure I get this right. Because of when the Reagan administration came in, it struck from the regulations of many... the regulations, you know, not the laws, but the regulations of many of agencies, a lot of the civil rights wording, so that the Civil Rights Restoration Act was written to reinstate it on the level of statute, so that reinstate these you know, rules and regulations on the level of statute, so that it couldn't be stricken again, and all it really says is it reestablishes and strengthens the ability, I mean, that the the proscription against discrimination in housing. Actually, it's mostly in employment, okay? Mm-hmm. And nowhere in the Civil Rights Restoration Act does it actually say the word sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in it. But the radical right used as an argument against the Civil Rights Restoration Act that if this law were established, it would make, what was the Jerry Falwell line? Your church would have to hire gay ministers, or your church would have to hire, your church schools would have to hire gay Sunday school teachers. That's what it was, that kind of thing. And the Civil Rights Restoration Act never said anything like that. It doesn't have the word sexual preference in it. It doesn't have, in fact, nowhere in it does it have any. It's not that simple litany of, you know, race, sex, color, creed. It's more rules and regulations about what kinds of things you can and can't do as an employer to abrogate your employee's civil rights. But it doesn't have that word in it. It was used by the opposition as the worst case fear that now everybody, all Sunday schools would have to hire gay Sunday school teachers, you know, just as that kind of argument always happens.
So that isn't a threat to the gay community then, that they overrode the veto.
Wouldn't it be positive that it restored certain rights, and
the override was a major victory for every. I mean, that was a major. You know, that was one of the Bork nomination and the Civil Rights Restoration Act was the first time that all of the quote-unquote minorities in this country came together and worked together to stop one thing. Mm-hmm. And the Bork one was the most amazing, because that was just people who never worked together before, black community and women's community, you know, women's activists and gay folks and First Amendment people and all that kind of stuff. And then that coalition was still in place, and it also then worked against to override the veto, and indeed it did. So that's hopeful to me. That's very hopeful.
With Bork, I was just amazed at how much money the minority groups, I guess you'd say, mm-hmm. raised to fight that.
Tons of money.
I think it does say that there are a lot of people that are sympathetic, not necessarily gay or lesbian, but they're very sympathetic to mm-hmm. that cause.
Well, because I think the reason that Bork went down, and this is one that I think we should, you know, as I said before, but I think people should think about more as you look at being sympathetic, is that the Bork got stuck on the issue of right to privacy. He stood up and said in his testimony he did not believe the right to privacy was constitutional. Well, you know, bingo. That pushes every button of, that should push every American's buttons, not just gays and lesbians, and not just women, because of course the right to privacy is the basis of Roe v. Wade decision. Okay, the woman's right to her body, you know, so that right to privacy was the argument that was used for it. So it's not just women and it's not just gays and lesbians, it's everybody. I mean, the right to privacy is a right that is not in the Bill of Rights, but it is implied by the Bill of Rights. And here was this guy who was going to be on the Supreme Court who was going to say, I don't believe in the right to privacy. And I think that's real, real inspirational that people came together and understood it. And I think that's where people of good faith and good, or people of goodwill who are non-gay and gays and lesbians can really come together and say, yeah, this stuff scares all of us. And we don't maybe necessarily have to like gays and lesbians or believe that they're religiously justified in faith or whatever, but we're talking about something that's very scary here. And that's the strategies. That's the strategies that we are using, and hopefully in various contexts around the country that other strategies like that can emerge, because otherwise, I think, you know, it's again using your Nazi Germany analogy. Once one group, you know, it's, that is justified to sort of abrogate the civil rights of one group, then everybody is really under the gun. And I am a true believer in the fact that, you know, racism equals sexism equals homophobia equals anti-Semitism, etc. All of those things, you can't say one's okay and the other one's not. You know, well, it's really bad to be racist, but it's okay to be homophobic. You know, it's just you can't, because then the whole structure falls down. And that's, I think, the strategy that we have to, that gays and lesbians have to use.
I think that's really a powerful concept, because the non-gay community can't really say we're different. Mm-hmm. We're all in this together in the mm-hmm. world, and I think that's really stressed at Holden. Mm-hmm. What I do really affects everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think too often I forget that. I just think, you know, mm-hmm. I'm me and I don't have any real impact on the world, and that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's oh, go ahead.
No, I guess I just really appreciate, you know, hearing this information from mm-hmm. you, because so often, you know, you think of it in terms of categories and that it doesn't affect you, but it does, because we are one human community. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of compassion, you know, for where you're at and where you're mm-hmm. going through, and I really appreciate you sharing this information. And I just, it really angers me to think of the violence and mm-hmm. the kind of treatment, you know, that you're subjected to, mm-hmm. and that, you know, we are a human community. We are here to love and support one another, and that we're not here to judge one another. We're really here to support and accept, and that really makes me angry.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I get angry with myself because I get real isolated from, you know, what other groups are going mm-hmm. through, and mm-hmm. that's not right either.
That's, I thank you. it's, As I said last week, we got into a good discussion. Actually, I removed myself from it, but there was a forum last week around sort of the biblical aspects and the religious aspects of this whole question. And as I stated at the very beginning, that's not my argument, not my issue. I'm not an issue to myself. If I'm an issue to you, then you need to discuss it with each other, but it's not my issue. So I just sort of sat and listened. And there were a couple of people in there who were very, you know, strongly saying that it's not ambiguous at all. The Bible says this is wrong, and the only way that you can save yourself is to, you know, is to accept grace from Jesus and change and blah blah blah. And people in the room were getting and arguing and blah 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 blah. And afterwards, people came up to me and said, how did you feel when these people said that? And I said, well, you know, I didn't feel personally attacked. And I was inspired by the fact that many people said, no, you can't, you know, the Bible's not a cookbook and all this kind of stuff. And then there was this good discussion. And I said, so I really didn't feel a desire to want to stand up and scream at these people. But I do, when people who have that attitude also have power, money, you know, influence and control in this society, you know, the Jesse Helmses of the world, then not only is it necessary for me to stand up and scream at it, but it's necessary for everyone in the room, that, you know, it's, we can, here at Holden, we can agree to disagree and play out each other's, you know, sort of listen and hear how other people think and play with each other's thoughts and blah, 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 blah. But when it gets over the mountain and down the hill and there's a Jesse Helms or there's a, you know, a Jerry Falwell or that kind of stuff, I really believe that then a solidarity is demanded, and maybe I would even want to say it's biblically mandated, you know, that we are all one people and we can't, you know, we can't isolate other people.
And the bottom line, and this was brought out in the Bible study this morning, that it says that we should love one another,
mm-hmm, right,
you know, regardless mm-hmm. of any group or any category. The bottom line is that we are here to love one another.
Mm-hmm. That's
That is it.
Yeah, that's the way I felt it. But it is really, there is a big difference
reality, yeah,
between having that discussion and then having it out there. I mean, the Helms Amendment, when we'll talk about this a little bit tomorrow. I don't have a watch on. What time is it?
Oh, okay. Okay, it's just about quarter to.
Okay, then I'll do my commercial and we'll go. The Helms Amendment, which was attached to something, I don't know when, but basically the Helms Amendment says that no government money can be spent on anything that would promote homosexuality. And it's very vague, right? And now the Helms Amendment, and we'll talk a little about this. You all maybe you got here recently, so you got in the mail before you left the C. Everett Koop mailing on AIDS. Well, I have the original, okay? I have what C. Everett Koop wrote, that then the Helms Amendment was invoked so that it was what you got was so watered down that it isn't enough information. I mean, if the populace needs to be...
didn't it just say, though, that the healthiest way is to abstain from sex, right, or have sex with one partner exclusively?
Right,
like,
right, that was the, right. Okay. Yeah, and it's... that's because of the Helms Amendment. And it also really played down actual language that talked about what you can and cannot do. You know, it sort of moved around it because the Helms Amendment was interpreted to mean that if you described any of these supposedly dangerous acts, you were promoting homosexuality. Now, that's dangerous to everybody, you know, and so in that light, that's, you know, I mean, that something like a Jesse Helms invoking this this kind of religious, you know, stricture can be dangerous to the whole populace. And so
I come from Utah, and you can imagine what's going on there with the Mormons. They can't communicate anyone who's gay, or there was an instance of a fellow dying of AIDS in Ogden, and they just abandoned him, you know. But I was glad that it made the front pages and they really exposed them for what they are, you know.
But
it's... And there again, they don't even want sex education in the schools,
right,
you know.
Right,
and
you know.
Really,
and that's really scary. Yeah. So we'll talk about that more tomorrow in the piece that I'm going to, tomorrow evening at 6:20, called The Politics of AIDS, where you know, we won't spend as much time on AIDS as a disease and what is AIDS and all the sort of, you know, medical stuff about it, but how AIDS is being played out in the public arena right now, and what's hopeful and what's scary about it, and ways in which folks can come to think and maybe come to be activists about issues around AIDS.